Hello and welcome to the MMQB Monday Morning NFL Podcast. I'm Gary Gramling.
I'm Jenny Francis.
I'm Con Rohr.
And we have some big headlines to go through this week, guys. We have a little bit of Tua silliness down in Miami. We have some stuff going on with Andy Dalton and promises made to. And we also have some serious stuff to do at the end of the show. Not that this first thing isn't serious, but maybe not beyond football serious. But we're starting off with Julio Jones. Julio Jones has been moved. He is off to Tennessee. The compensation was the Falcons receive a 2022 second-round pick and a 2023 fourth-rounder. Julio Jones and a 2023 sixth-round pick go back to the Falcons. So we finally reach the end of this storyline, which, I don't know, I thought it might carry us all the way through August. I guess I'm a little bit sad to see it go. But the issue was finding a trade partner who was going to be able to fit with what the Falcons had to do here, not only in terms of the compensation they got, but the salary cap situation in Atlanta.
Yeah, I think the price that the Falcons got back, evidently, that was the best that the market would bear for a partner that was willing to take on the entire salary, which was the Falcons' top concern, was clearing that off their books so they could sign their rookie class. And I think it makes sense that it probably the market topped out with a second round pick. Don't think anyone was going to give up a first round pick and then also take on that salary. But one question that I have is the Falcons' plan from this point forward, because they decided not to go the route despite being in prime position to take a quarterback in this year's draft, if there was one that they liked still there at number four. But they passed on the opportunity to take a quarterback this year and decided to go forward with Matt Ryan. You would think that what would pair with that plan would be keeping Julio Jones. But sticking with Matt Ryan and trading Julio Jones is kind of a mismatching of directions for the team here. So I'm a little confused as to what their plans are for 2021 and moving forward.
Especially, too, when you consider the fact that, okay, so he's going to Tennessee, a team that runs the same offense as the one that the Falcons are currently running and the one that Julio Jones thrived in when he made the Super Bowl with the Falcons. And what's interesting about that offense is, you know, if your number one receiver isn't a track star, then you need Julio Jones. Like, that's the only other kind of guy that works as a number one receiver in that offense. And so, you know, because you need him to be physical, you need him to be a precise route runner, you need him to be able to beat up on cornerbacks. And so to me it doesn't make sense, because if you're Atlanta, you need him to make this work, unless there's something that we're not seeing, something we don't know about Calvin Ridley, something we don't know about their plans for Kyle Pitts. And, it, you know, if I'm Tennessee, I'm thrilled at this point, because, you know, you basically just got all of the, you know, you upgraded from Corey Davis and you have a receiver that fits the scheme perfectly. But I don't know how Atlanta doesn't see that, because they're running the same offense.
Yeah, it, I guess on the Ryan front, and again, look, if they didn't like Justin Fields and they didn't like Mac Jones, like, yeah, you know, you don't take a quarterback when it's all said and done. But they apparently knew back in March Julio had asked for this trade and asked to keep it quiet, and maybe was a little bit surprised that he announced it himself on Fox Sports 1. But they knew this in March. So you would think at the very least they would have done their due diligence on the quarterbacks. Maybe it's a little bit of, if we're going to be optimists about this, maybe it's a little bit of, okay, they didn't love Justin Fields or Mac Jones, but also maybe they're looking at Matt Ryan and saying, like, we can get 5 years out of Matt Ryan here. We saw what Matt Ryan did under Kyle Shanahan. This is loosely, conceptually, a similar offense here, and we think he has some stuff left. And now that we have, you know, Calvin Ridley is probably a bona fide number one, who, by the way, they're going to have to pay very soon. And now you add Kyle Pitts, and I guess you could say it makes sense, maybe.
Yeah, that's a fair point, Gary. I mean, they may not have liked Fields or Jones, and thus they would go forward with Ryan, and that may have been their plan all along anyway. But we've talked a lot about the Falcons, and Connor brings up a good point. I mean, for the Titans, this is fantastic. I think on an earlier podcast, we had talked about what was the thing that the Titans hadn't done to get better this offseason, or, you know, they didn't seem to have made a splashy move. Well, this is it. And now they have A.J. Brown, Derrick Henry, and Julio Jones. You know, it's an offense that Julio will thrive in. Plus, you have the incredible threat of the run game, which Atlanta didn't have last season. And so the Titans get a lot of loaded boxes from the opposing defense, which should open a lot of opportunities up for Julio. And they have two fantastic receivers. I mean, it's in a division where they're clearly the favorites, but they're also one of the top teams in the whole conference.
Yeah. I think we fool ourselves sometimes, like, and I don't know anybody or anybody that's, you know, going to check themselves and say they're being 100% honest. That's going to stand up on a soapbox and say, I think the Falcons got tremendous value for Julio Jones today. And, you know, maybe it bears it out. Maybe they know something about Julio, and maybe, you know, he is really past his athletic prime, and his second round pick ends up looking good in a few years. But as of right now, like, I cannot imagine, like, just sitting there and talking yourself into a 2-4 as a good thing. Like, you know, you're just looking around in your war room, and you're looking around and you're saying, okay, you know, this guy is no longer with us, but we have a second and a fourth round pick. I don't think that sits well with anybody in Atlanta, or at least unless there's something we don't know, that shouldn't sit well with anybody in Atlanta.
Yeah. I mean, maybe there's a scenario where Julio wants another contract if he has another couple big years, but also it's like, cool, Julio had another couple big years. That was
right.
That was a good thing. That's not a bad problem to have at that point. I'll say this, and I said a couple shows ago, I mean, Julio Jones is, like, loved and respected by teammates, by coaches, by fans, by, I don't know, enemies. I mean, everyone has just the utmost respect for the guy. He is absolutely, like, every team would want him in their locker room and want him in their building if you're trying to build your program. So it makes all the sense in the world here for the Titans. I will say the one guy I will peg as a loser in this trade is Todd Downing. He's the most fascinating assistant coach in the league to me. Todd Downing a couple years ago was maybe on the verge of being a rising coaching star. He was taking over the Raiders offense. Derek Carr was maybe this young, sort of ready to ascend to MVP type of quarterback, and it just all went sour there. And then he was out, and then he sort of, you know, laid low for a couple years in Tennessee, and now he's getting his second shot as an offense coordinator, as a play caller. He's replacing Arthur Smith, who, I mean, if you could make the argument Arthur Smith was the best play caller in the league the last couple of years, so Downing has to replace him already. And if the talent was a little bit worse, maybe you could be like, you know, they were down a little bit this year, but hey, what are you going to do? I mean, you know, the Josh Reynolds replacing Corey Davis, it just wasn't meant to be. But now they're kind of so stacked at the skill positions, it's like, if they're great, it'll be like, oh, what, Downing? I mean, look at all the talent he has to work. Anyone could make it work here. And if it doesn't work out, then it's like, oh, Downing blew it. Like, Ryan Tannehill might just have an off year. That might be the way it goes here.
Wow.
Ryan Tannehill could have an off year. Derrick Henry could finally start behaving like a running back who's carried the ball like 400 times a year. You know, I mean, that's coming at some point. You know, the bills on that, you know, on that way of life are coming due at some point. So, you know, I'm with you. Poor Todd.
Well, that is a sobering Monday morning take, Gary. I imagine that Todd Downing was enjoying his Sunday. He was probably celebrating. I have this new weapon. My offense is going to be fantastic this year. And here's Gary Gramling to say, well, it's not going to live up to expectations no matter what. No win situation for Todd Downing.
Anyone could have led the league in scoring with these guys. And then if it ends up being their fifth in scoring, it's like, oh, well, what an underachieving unit here. Look at all these guys they have. But
all right, that's one way to look at it.
Look, I think Todd Downing will do well. I think I think this is a really nice second act for him. But it's just this kind of like turns up the pressure just a little bit.
All right, fair
to
enough.
An uncomfortable level, maybe.
Fair enough. But as I'm sure we'll hear the coaching line quoted many times this summer. Well, it's a great problem to have, isn't it? Isn't that what coaches always say?
It's a great problem to have until everyone's calling for your job.
If you're Julio Jones, would you rather be in, like, some players, like, you know, I feel like it's like you force your way out, you know, and but then, like, where are you? You know what I mean? And is this where you'd want to go? I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question.
You guys are really delivering a lot of things to think about this Monday morning, but I appreciate it. The podcast needs some tension. I mean, that's a fair point too, Connor. It's the grass is always greener, and then you end up there, and is it as good as what you expected?
We're all going to die one day. Does any of this matter? No, I think it's a good landing. Schematically, it's certainly a good landing spot here. I don't know. Does anyone want to be on an AFC team that's not the Chiefs? It's like if he was going to pick his spot, you pick the Chiefs. And if the Chiefs aren't interested, well, okay. Well, you gotta do something else. There was some buzz about he wanted to go to the Patriots. I don't know how much was behind that. It sounds like the Patriots were not terribly interested at this point. There are a lot of Patriots put out some interesting messages through their surrogates over the last couple of years. A year ago, it was Jarrett Stidham would have been a first round pick in 2020. And it's like, I don't think that's right. That doesn't sound right. It was Julio Jones dying to get to New England. I'm sure he would have gone there. I'm sure he would have happily gone there had he been traded there. But I don't know. Kansas City has to be the top of everyone's list if you want to win a Super Bowl.
Right. Assuming the Falcons wanted to get him out of the NFC, which they did. Yes, the Chiefs would be the obvious pick, and everything else is a gamble. I mean, even going to the best team in a conference or in the league is a gamble anyway, but it's even more of a gamble if you don't go to the best team.
Jenny and I know this because we covered the 2010 New York Jets.
Oh, man. This is just this is my favorite bit of all time, Connor. Just going to sustain us.
Ladainian Tomlinson and Braylon Edwards. Santonio Holmes.
I can't wait until 2040 when we're talking over whatever medium exists then in media and just talking about the 2010 Jets. Yeah. It's going to be great.
My grandkids will just be like, I don't want to go over to grandpa's house. He just talks about somebody named Dustin Keller and Santonio Holmes and how they should have ran the ball with Ladainian Tomlinson at the goal line, or should have run the ball with Sean Green at the goal line and still Ladainian Tomlinson.
And listen, there are a lot of future grandparents right now who live in Atlanta who will be talking about the today that the Falcons traded away franchise legend Julio Jones. Mm-hmm. Perhaps. And then he goes to win a Super Bowl. Yeah.
That's the bummer. That's the bummer for the Falcons. And you break up with your franchise guy. And yeah, that's sad. That is a little bit sad. So we will end on a sad note with the Julio Jones conversation.
It is sad for Atlanta. I mean, what a fantastic player. Incredibly fun to watch. Sure, there have been some injuries along the way, but it's a contact sport. And, you know, he's 32. Okay. You know, so we missed some games last season. But all signs point to there still being a lot left for Julio. And hopefully we get to see it with the Titans this year. But yeah, big bummer for Atlanta.
Positive. I can end it on a positive note. Julio Jones is going to get to stay, if he wants, at the Union Station Hotel in Nashville, which is beautiful, and right down the street from the stadium. And so that's, I mean, that would get me fired up about a move to Tennessee. So
there you go, Connor.
You ever stay in the Union Station Marriott?
I've never stayed there, but I have been to the lobby there, the lobby bar, and it's lovely.
The best. Just the best.
All right. Let's get silly for a few moments here. We have to go down to Miami and talk about some salacious headlines that Tua Tagovailoa didn't know he had a playbook. he had no idea. That's what I'm gathering from the headlines I see.
This is the time of year when playbook is in many headlines. It's, you know, learning a new playbook from the new coach, or as Connor and I have referenced many times before, the Jets circa 2012, having two playbooks, one for Mark Sanchez or Tim Tebow. It's also the time to overanalyze what a scrutinized quarterback says about his previous knowledge of the playbook, which is exactly where we find ourselves with Tua.
Or the Jets in 2011.
2011.
where we had to ask every player if he received a playbook during the there was the Rex Ryan book tour after his second straight AFC championship game, and I was there, and I remember a frantic phone call between us, and he said, gotta ask if Muhammad Wilkerson got his playbook. And I remember that now, like, and that was like a big it felt like a big victory when I was like, because he left, he was shepherded out of the Barnes and Noble. I was like, Rex, did Muhammad Wilkerson get his playbook?
And, amazing.
You know, yeah. So he got it. So everybody's all good. Got the playbook.
I was going to say, I really needed closure on that anecdote, whether he got the playbook or not.
He got the playbook. Everybody's good.
So we know now Tua struggled as a rookie. That's somewhat expected, considering the fact that he was coming off a major hip surgery, the fact that we had the strange offseason. And look, we say all the time, some guys learn better on the field than the virtual type of setting. Tua might be one of those guys ultimately, but the comment he made was essentially, you know, he knows the playbook better now. If you were to parse these comments, you would say this is a guy entering his second year who's saying, I know the playbook better now than I did a year ago, which seems just completely normal.
Yeah, and so just to kind of clue everybody into kind of how this works, you know, a player will say something on Zoom. It'll get written a certain way. It'll get picked up by somebody who wasn't on the Zoom, who then takes a segment of the quote that was written a certain way and then places a different headline on it. And then people make a big deal out of it and say, oh, my God, Tua didn't know the playbook last year. And so let me venture a little bit of a solution to this problem, which the NFL seems to want to do the opposite of, which is, hey, let us back into the locker room. We all got vaccinated. Well, I don't want to speak for a lot of us, but I did. I know Jenny did. We're ready to go back into locker rooms. And so let us back in there. And then we can go back to Tua and say, hey, I just want to clarify this before I write this. You meant this, or did you mean this? And then we don't have to have these stupid conversations. So,
yeah, this is a particularly stupid conversation. And Connor, that is a important point to make. I agree. I think more interactions between the media and players lead to less miscommunications, lead to a better understanding of what someone is trying to say. It leads to more in-depth and thoughtful answers than you might get over a Zoom. So yes, hear, hear to locker room access.
Human interaction, and then the people who are most capable of communicating those interactions to others. That's a good way to do it.
What else are we thinking? And, you know, I think there's a particular frustration because this happened to a story that I wrote a couple of years ago. I remember, again, it all comes back to the 2011-2012 Jets. Stephen Hill was their second round draft pick. And I remember I did a big story on him going into his second season. And he said that, yeah, you know, I didn't quite grasp the playbook as well the first year. And then you write that, then it gets rewritten as Stephen Hill didn't understand the playbook. And then you get a call from the Jets saying, how could you do this? But it's like, no, this is what I wrote. Well, then where did this come from? I don't know. And so, you know, there's this whole back and forth, and, you know, and then you go back to the player and say, hey, you know, I this is what I wrote. And I just want you to be clear on this, and we can foster this sort of understanding. But instead, now, you know, Tua, rightfully so, has every reason to not want to do another Zoom or to not feel like going on there and giving a great explanation for a question or something like that. And, you know, here we are, you know?
Yeah, I mean, and if you look at his comments, he was saying that he wasn't comfortable checking plays, alerting plays, that he didn't necessarily have an advanced ability or any ability to make a lot of changes at the line of scrimmage. And I actually don't think that that's that unusual for a rookie quarterback.
Right.
All of that stuff grows with time. So he went from trying to be honest and giving an honest assessment of how much better he could be this year, especially because he's already facing a lot of scrutiny. I think this is going to be one of the more interesting storylines of this season because he faced so much scrutiny last year and there were so many calls for the Dolphins to move on from him after he played, you know, barely half a season. And now he's trying to be candid and saying, this is where I can make a lot of gains in year two. And people are saying, oh my God, this means he was terrible last year. The other thing is, I remember Patrick Mahomes making a comment at the end of one of his first few seasons. I think it was after his first season as a starter, where he said, I didn't even really know how to read defenses. And the response from everyone, and again, yes, the awe of Mahomes is warranted, but I remember the response being, wow, imagine how much better he'll be when he understands defenses fully. And, yeah. And this is like the polar opposite of that. This is like, well, that's horrible, rather than being optimistic for what's to come.
It is. You have to lock it into your narrative and run with that, and you can't be shaken from your narrative no matter what happens.
It's almost like we have these painful preconceived biases on everything, and it's the filter from which we see the world.
That's the other thing. We do need reporters back in the locker rooms, and the other part of this equation is people do need to find trusted sources and also to read past the headline and to read past the tweet and all of that stuff. I'm the guy who writes the headlines and the tweets, and my goodness, you should not be going off of what I'm writing about Connor's and Jenny's work here. It's just a crime. But as far as this goes, there's just this game of telephone when it comes to the aggregation of a lot of these stories, and I mean, it's not going to go away. There's no point in complaining about it, but I'll complain about it anyway. But yeah, you know, that's how a story that starts as Tua saying, I can get a better feel for this offense and this playbook turns into Tua forgot to ask for a playbook last year and never looked at it, and purple monkey dishwasher. And then we all go on with our lives.
At the risk of messing up the audio on this, because I got yelled at once for doing this on when I was working somewhere else, but I was going to pound the desk and say, okay, let's pound that stupid story into submission. There we go. Like, that's it. Beat it down. It's gone. It's done. I tell the story now. I was at NFL Network and I was on TV, which I hate doing because I'm not good at it. And I had like a little, you had the earbud in, and the producer is like, okay, 5 seconds, whatever. And so I'm making a point, like live on NFL Network, and I say, and pencil in the Browns for the playoffs, and I hit the desk, and then someone just yells, stop hitting the desk. And so I don't do that anymore in any place, but I was clearly shook by that. But anyway, I'm air hitting the desk. Let's move on. That's
all right. Let's move on to Andy Dalton then. That's gonna get us going here. I'll say this whole sense of Andy Dalton was promised that he'd be the starter in March or whenever they signed him. It just is. I don't know what that promise is worth, because I guess if Justin Fields goes and lights things up this summer and they go with Justin Fields, there's no real consequence to taking the job away from Andy Dalton, except Andy Dalton's feelings would be hurt. Like, I'm just not sure why this continues to be a thing that we sort of zero in on. And I guess I put together a really bad outline here. I hate all these stories, but it's just like, Andy Dalton was promised a starting job, so no getting out of that now. He has to be the week one starter. There's nothing you can do about it.
It's like one of the silliest things ever. It's just like, the bear, like, you just imagine the phone call. It's like, hi, this is Matt Nagy. It's like, hi, hey, it's Andy. And he's just like, okay, you want to play with for us? Yeah. Can I be the week one starter? Yeah. Do you promise? Yes. And then it's like, okay. And then they draft Justin Fields and it's like, but you promised, like we're 4 years old again. You have to win the job. And everyone's like, well, Andy Dalton would have picked somewhere else to go if he knew he wasn't going to start. Where else was he going to go? Where is he starting? What other team is being like, well, we would have taken him and made him the week one starter. You want to go to Denver? Go ahead. Get yourself traded to the Broncos.
Yeah. It does also remind me that there are some teams that are just going with no other options at quarterback. So like the Bears have, they have Dalton, who can play until Fields is ready, right? The Jets don't seem to have any backup plan for Zach Wilson. And I know I'm veering off topic a little bit, but it just reminds me that isn't it better to have options versus to have just only one option, that you have to start the rookie week one?
You would think so.
Andy Dalton is a very nice backup plan in every sense of the word. But yeah, it's if Justin Fields is like ready to go and you've been in that Bears locker room and you've seen the quarterback play that your team has put out the last couple of years, and then Matt Nagy's like, all right, well, Fields is the better guy, but you know, we promised and I'm a man of my word. So Andy Dalton's going out there week one. It doesn't matter. And and like you said, Jenny, if Justin Fields is not ready to start week one, which is a very real possibility, then Andy Dalton's your starter. But this whole, like, we have to determine the Bears week one starter right now, or not even right now, we had to determine it in March when their roster was not completed yet. I don't know. it's a mad, 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 mad world.
Well, I have a solution, Gary. I know that closely follow the Bills, and so perhaps this resonates with you.
Yep.
Which year are we talking? 2015, where Tyrod Taylor was going to be the starter, but they put Matt Cassel under center first. So Matt Cassel technically started the first game for the Bills, but then Tyrod Taylor was the quarterback. So they could do that. Put Andy Dalton out there for the first snap and then play Fields.
That is very true. Now we're solving problems for Matt Nagy.
That's what we're here to do.
Imagine like the day before the first game and Justin Fields has been ripping it up in practice and all the players are like, oh my God, we're finally going to, you know, be a good team again. And then Matt Nagy calls a giant meeting and says, guys, today I'm going to talk to you about something important. Keeping your promises. Like really, you're gonna like, this is a meaningless gesture, you know, and it's insane that a player actually believed this. Like, it's crazy that a player believed any words that came out of a desperate coach's mouth. You should never, ever, ever believe anything that a coach tells you, ever.
Well,
unless it's like a play. It's like, okay, you got to run in this direction. It's like, okay, I vaguely think that you're telling the truth. Anything else, double check it with somebody else.
I'd love to pound the table right now, but we're not allowed to.
We're going to get another, we're going to get a message from producer Shelby. Stop doing that.
Shelby Royson, stop banging the table. Maybe we'll replace it with like blow into your microphone. That is now how we emphasize things.
There you go.
In an even more annoying way. All right. So we've run through our sort of fringy starting quarterback roster in this show so far, and we're now going to move on to some stuff that's much more serious. And two things that were in the headlines this past week. We're going to start with Toradol and the conversation around Toradol, and I kind of want to throw it to Jenny because number one, Jenny's kind of smarter than both of us, Connor. I'm very sorry about that, but I mean, you do have a deeper knowledge of this than either Connor and I do.
Yeah, honestly, Gary, the biggest surprise to me was that it has taken so long for there to be a stance on Toradol. I have had conversations with physicians and people involved in the medical field relating to sports medicine, specifically football, dating back several years about the risks of Toradol. What was highlighted in this recommendation that it not be used by players is the increased bleeding risk. And it's a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory. And one of the most extreme side effects is an increase in bleeding. And that can exacerbate a lot of injuries, but concussions is one of them. So if you have athletes in a collision sport using Toradol, it's a dangerous mix. And I think there's been an awareness of this for a long time. But because this is such a violent sport and players have long relied on something like Toradol to be able to play every week, this will now result in a big change because players do not have this anymore. And I think that's a good thing. I think it should be outlawed. It should have been outlawed a long time ago. But it also, to me, goes back to the idea that there should be more than one bye week, that there should be, you know, that could be used to ensure that players don't have to play on short weeks. You know, a study like this really reminds you of, not that we need a reminder, but I think we do need a reminder sometimes of how dangerous this game is. And the fact that there are more measures that should be taken with the schedule to protect the players better than is being done currently.
There are so many, you know, there's so many options out there, which is which is crazy to me that none of them have been actively explored. And I know that part of the issue certainly is that the players are, you know, the players are unionized, and that there's, you know, if you wanted some sort of mass holistic program, it would have to go through a bargaining process so that, you know, people could find out more about the players, what makes them tick and how they could help them. But at the same time, like, there's got to be a better answer than, like, you know, Advil times 10,000 just being shot into you day after day after day. And, you know, even the lay description of it is like, you know, even if you just look at it up on drugs.com, it says this should not be considered a long-term solution for anything, you know. And like, even the most easily accessible information on this drug is like, hey, stop, you know, stop after like 2 days. And these guys are getting it for months, for weeks, for years. Remember Greg Bishop, our colleague, did that thing with Andrew Whitworth earlier this year where he weaned his body completely off of painkillers, even original strength Advil, out of a fear of, you know, exactly where we're going with this. And so I think it's crazy to me that it's gone on for this long. It's crazy all of the issues that it's led to post-retirement for players, you know, who have grappled with their own issues of painkiller addiction or, you know, alcohol, stuff like that to ease the pain from football. And so it's just it blows my mind that it's taken this long to be like, hey, you know, maybe we want to stop doing this, you know, and they just feel so far behind the eight ball now in terms of alternate solutions for pain management. Like, I remember people asking Goodell about marijuana 8 years ago, 9 years ago, and there doesn't seem to be any effort to incorporate any sort of holistic pain killing, you know, outside of what athletes can do outside of the facility. You know, a lot of them are turning to acupuncture, you know, massage therapy, all that stuff, but on their own time, you know, stuff that they don't get in the facility. And so I think the entire process just seems very backwards to me.
Yeah, I don't want to advocate for the cannabis solution, but I mean, just anecdotally, you hear so many guys,
right,
players.
There's a lot that we don't know about that, yep, either. And I think that that's important to say that. I'm not saying that's a blanket solution, you know, but it's just like, how has there been no effort in terms of like a pilot testing, you know, yeah, program or research or, you know, anything in instead of just being like, yeah, no, just get your shot, you know?
Well, that's the thing. Like, apologies, Connor. I didn't want to necessarily shoot down your suggestion. I do think it's there's so much anecdotal evidence from retired players saying that this has helped them. It just seems a little bit ridiculous that we haven't sort of, moved this along faster as far as examining that as a possible solution going forward. But I did want to, you know, Jenny touched on this real quick, that you could alleviate some of this with sort of smarter, more sensible scheduling. And it just sort of blew my mind when the double bye week was put out there. Do you extend the season that way instead of adding a 17th game per team? And the feedback was kind of like, well, you know, the networks don't really want to have such light schedules midseason. Like, you know, the CBS and Fox don't want those Sunday afternoon slates to be lightened up. And it's just kind of like, are we reaching a point where the argument is we can't do this because maybe people won't watch football? Haven't we sort of crossed that threshold where it's like people will watch whatever NFL game you put in front of them on Sunday? It does not matter if it ends up being, we got three matchups that aren't great. They're going to sit down and watch it. That's how it's been without a doubt for like a decade now.
Yeah. And if you had the double bye week, there would be a lot of scenarios in which you could either eliminate or reduce the number of times that players play on a short week. And then you also have this built-in second rest period. I thought that was a real missed opportunity. If they're going to make major changes to the schedule and the way a season is played, and, you know, for a long time that seemed, oh, well, this is, you know, we like these different benchmarks of the year and this is what the schedule is. And then, of course, you know, they always want expansion. But the idea of not taking that opportunity to add a second bye week for the purpose of player health was really a missed opportunity.
Agreed. Another story that really came back to the headlines this week, and this is something that originally came up back in January and February, but I think some folks might have missed it because it was around the Super Bowl, and people tend to watch the Super Bowl, even if the game is not a great game, because people watch football no matter what is on. But the league, in the concussion settlement, as far as determining whether individual players were eligible for settlement money, they were relying, or the doctors doing the examinations were relying on race norming. Now, what that means is a lot of these retired players, they don't have the cognitive baseline test. They didn't do that during their playing days, so there's no way of measuring an individual player's sort of drop off as far as cognitive ability goes. So they relied on averages, and they split those averages by race. There was essentially one quantitative approach for white players, and there was a different one that was lower for black players. And because it was lower, if a black retired player, tested lower, because the gap wasn't as large between what that average was, they would not be eligible, or they were less likely to be eligible for settlement money, which in a league where, look, all these guys, they went to college, a lot of them got degrees. I don't know if there's really a reason to rely on race norming in such a situation here. And now the league is finally backing off that after kind of holding on for a little while.
Yeah, there's a part in the settlement agreement, it's specifically listed that there are five domains of cognitive function. In each domain, there are several tests that contribute test scores for consideration for your settlement amount. Test selection in the domains was based on the availability of demographically adjusted normative data for Caucasians and African Americans. So it spells it out as part of the settlement agreement, exactly what you just described, Gary.
To me, the whole thing, and you can lump it in with Toradol, is like, here is sort of all the stuff that the NFL keeps like tripping over to keep in the closet. Like, you know, this is kind of the way, whether it's their legal arm or whoever, like, this is kind of just the way that they think. This was how things were going for years. And there was such an erosion of morality over time. And I'm not saying like this is solely the fault of Roger Goodell, but it's incredible how we get to this point where we're just now today, you know, trying to unhook players from prescription drugs. We're trying to be able to look at our black and white players the same way and treat them the same way after they all helped get the league to this point. And it's just unbelievable to me. And so, you know, I thought it was interesting that, you know, our old colleague, our MMQB creator, Peter King, had written something about what was next for Roger Goodell and as he reaches the end of his next installment of his contract. And I think that addressing the NFL's past candidly is a great way to set them up for a better future, because the longer that we continue to go down this path, the longer that they try to sneak this stuff out on a summer Friday and, you know, and hope that we forget about it. Like, the more of this stuff is just going to keep coming out. More retired players are going to keep speaking out about their issues. Everybody's going to be honest about, you know, what they feel the experience did to them once they get out. And so why not get ahead of it and say, hey, you know, there was a long time where we just did not have a pulse on this. Like, we did not have any control or not, you know, and it was completely irresponsible to use painkillers this way, to treat players in a settlement this way. Like, and we have to get a hold of this stuff. And I just think that it's mind-boggling to me that these are basic human things that are just not being addressed whatsoever. And this is 2021. And that to me is pretty mind-blowing.
Yeah. And I think it's also jarring to see what has happened here, because as we just discussed, this was part of the settlement. So it's not a surprise to the NFL that it was in there or to, you know, some of the attorneys that signed off on this, right? And, you know, it was explicitly stated in the settlement agreement, and the NFL's initial argument was that this is something that is normal, that there are generally different demographic standards. Now they're saying they've come up with a panel to create new standards and that they will both prospectively apply this to people who newly file for settlements and also retroactively. But what we don't know at this point is still how much money were Black players denied because of the disparate standards. And for people who are in this position, who are dealing with dementia or other neurological impairment, you need that money to help pay for care now. So there's a lot of time lost. So even if they ultimately make up those payments to people who were wronged in the past, that money could have made a difference in years of care. And so I think an important piece of that, and I know that the judge has asked for a report on how this was applied, but hopefully there is some somewhat of a examination of how exactly players were hurt in the past. And, you know, you could also argue that they shouldn't just be paid what they should have gotten paid, that they should also be paid some restitution for this mistake.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with that more. And I guess when you just kind of step back, the thing that bothers me most is, it's like, if you're the NFL, clearly you made mistakes in the 90s the way you, and in the 80s the way you approach these things. And to sort of dig in now on these really inconsequential dollar amounts for some of these guys. And yeah, the NFL is not a charity, but at the same time, this is an accounting error, what they would have had to pay to these guys. And the fact that they just dig in with this sort of, rules is rules type of thing, and they won't sort of give that extra leeway on some of these settlement things, it's just, it's so incredibly off-putting and just upsetting from a moral standpoint that they're doing this.
Either of these stories that we talked about at the back end of this show, like, if you're in charge of whatever the NFL's legal strategy, if you were overseeing, you know, NFL physicians who were doling out these painkillers, like, how do you look at yourself in the mirror, at your kids, at your spouse, at whatever, and with a completely clear heart explain what was going on there? Like, it blows my mind. You know, there's a lot of stuff in the NFL, you know, where on a weekly basis we're like, oh, this is ridiculous, and I think that maybe sometimes, but not really. I mean, the NFL gets kind of held up as this bellwether of society, and they're not prepared to handle it, and, you know, but this is basic human rights stuff. Basic, you know, day one, care for your fellow human rights stuff. And it was just completely unfulfilled for decades. And it's really jarring.
I don't know how to transition to the end of this. That's a wrap.
Ta-da.
That we'll was a guys. Great point, Connor. I was like, was. I don't, what was I going to say? Well said, which is what I always say. But yeah, that was a good, I'm trying to think how to transition out of it. There's no easy way.
I'll wrap it up.
All right.
I'll do it. I'll get it done. Thanks for going out on a high note, Connor.
No problem, Gary. That's what I'm here for.
This is supposed to steadily dwindle until we just have an awkward silence, and then I read the end credits. And that's how the show is supposed to end. All right.
That's fine, you know. Here, let's end on a happy note. Jenny's wearing one of my favorite hats of all time, a classic, classic Glacier National Park hat, which has been a mainstay of, whereas Jenny has been with me through a lot of hat trial and error through my life, and I've always kind of counted her as my closest confidant whenever I purchase a new hat, which is something that I need to do more of now that I don't have hair. But her Glacier National Park hat has been like a beacon of sturdiness and stability over the years, and I always enjoy when I see that over Zoom.
But still not the longest lasting hat in my family. My dad is currently wearing the FIFA South Africa, what was that, 2011?
Yes.
FIFA World Cup? Yeah, so it's his, I think I've told this story before, but my mom like won some package at the bank, and it was like this little fold-up cooler, which I have in my apartment, two of these hats and like a soccer ball. And like, for whatever, my dad doesn't like soccer at all, but it like fits his head. It was just like one of those hats that looked really good. So he wore the first one until it was like faded and frayed. And then my mom's like, well, I have a second one. So he's on his second one. So, and it's still his favorite hat. But my mom doesn't let him wear it to like doctor's appointments. She makes him wear a newer Penn State hat that doesn't look, because it's, you know, this one's a little ratty because I think we're several years into this hat as well. So, anyway.
So what you're saying is style gets passed down.
Yeah,
from
that's
generation
right. That's,
to generation.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. That's what I'm saying. Yeah.
All right, guys. Well, this was like our fourth show together, and I don't know. I think Righteous Anger kind of fits us well as far as this goes.
That was a great soliloquy by Connor. Well made points.
Yeah, good job, everybody. I mean, you know, we're I'm ready to vent with you guys in person. Let's do it. You know,
yeah.
Pretty soon, huh? We'll all just be listening to me scream and holler in a in a cramped studio somewhere, and you'll all be wishing you were back at your houses on Zoom.
The MMQB Monday Morning NFL Podcast is Jenny Brentis, Connor Orr, and me, Gary Gramling. We are produced by Shelby Royson. SI's executive producer of podcasts is Scott Brody. Mark Mravick is emeritus editor of the MMQB. Andy Benoit is the founder of the MMQB NFL Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to this feed on Apple Podcasts. And once you do, please leave a rating and review because it really does help other people find the show, which is also available on Spotify, Radio.com, Stitcher, SI.com, and wherever else you listen to podcasts.